Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
This episode of the Football History Rewind, as we go year by year through football history, we'll go through some of the most notable rules changes and events of American football in the season of 1901. So stay tuned for the Great Gridiron History.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And the history takes us year by year. We are Football History Rewind is the series, and we have been covering all of the 19th century in football. And now we are in our first year of the 20th century as football enters that new century. Football in the late 1890s was a period of calmness. And as far as the changes and transformation of the game, the players and the coaches use this period to perfect their systems and even tweak some old schemes to work under the new rules imposed in 1896. But in 1900, Walter Camp once again was thinking of strategy rather than rules revisions to preserve the game, as he helped transform rugby into the game of football. Camp and a small group of men were exploring a novel idea of the Yale coach to take advantage of the common defensive line strategy of the day. It was common in 1900 for the defensive rush line forwards, as they were called, to change their opposition low at the snap of the ball and to drive them backwards. Camp's idea was to create a play that could use this forward momentum of the rush line against them by devising a play that would create an opening quickly and could catch a defense off guard and render the front line ineffective because of being unable to reestablish their balance as a runner would shoot past them and their forward momentum. When a defensive forward shot forward, he would have great difficulty in occupying the coverage of a hole. The runner could then easily slip through the defender before he could regain his position to stop the ball carrier. What came of this was a reincarnation of the famous Yale tackleback play, but this time it was used with a whole new strategy as quite a few years earlier. While Yale was pummeling opponents with their new offensive strategy in the East, Northwestern University had an effective tandem formation of its own in the Midwest. Northwestern's head coach, C.M. Hollister, devised what is known at the time as the Northwestern Tandem. In this formation, there were four men in a direct line behind the center and perpendicular to the line of scrimmage. The first man was a quarterback, and directly behind him was a large blocking back that was often referred to as the heavy forward. Behind these two men were the halfbacks. The offensive strategy was gained not by declaring a strong or weak side of the formation, thus keeping a defense honest and from playing one side or the other. The offense could then pick a weak point of the rush line by pounding two blocking backs through a hole ahead of the runner. The concept and strategy of the I formation was born. But was this the calm before the storm? Some think it was, because the football rules makers were fairly content in 1900 and 1901 and did little to employ new revisions to the game's rules. Only a few changes took place in this period. One was a very important definition that would be the basis for the declaration of a score. A touchdown was defined as being made when any part of the ball is on, above, or across the goal line. Very important. If you remember, the word touchdown from rugby means the ball had to cross the goal line and the player had to touch it to the ground. Thus the word touchdown. Other revisions at the time abolished obsolete play such as the throw-in, similar to modern basketball or soccer play-to-start play, when a ball went out of bounds. This type of play had not been used since the early 1880s after the scrimmage was instituted, but it was still listed in the rules of the game. It's a good example of the complacency of the rules committee during this period, so that they had time to take care of some of those housekeeping type issues they had been putting off for past years due to bigger fish to fry. Football still had enemies, though, as they used this calm period to gather ammunition once again to try to eliminate the sport from existence. In this plot to get rid of football, there's still that part of the public that wanted the sport abolished due to its closeness of participants to each other, which resulted in rough play. The year since 1896 rules reforms had seen drastic decrease in injury players, but nonetheless, the football reformers also came to life, and some wanted to use the situation to change football back to the wide-open style of play it once had. At the same time, a professor at the University of Illinois was quietly keeping a precise record of football injury statistics. Both those pro and con to the current style of play awaited the results of Dr. Edwin G. Dexter's stats once the rumor of the experiments was exposed to the public. The results were heavily in favor of the side supporting the current style of play, and the reformists and abolitionists' hopes were squandered for the time being. The Rules Committee had a victory in this matter, but they still recognized that they still had to instill some aspect of wide-open play to the current game in order to pacify reformists for future uprisings. Their answer was to change the rules to make it illegal for a player who directly received the snap to be able to advance the ball forward. Up to this time, the ball could only be advanced by the second or more player who touched the ball after the snap. There will still be caution, though, as the forward run of the quarterback could only occur if he crossed the line of scrimmage 5 or more yards away from the point where the ball was actually snapped from. This change resulted in an answer to a question that is very difficult to find. Why is football referred to as a gridiron? Go ahead and search online for the answer, and I'll bet your results will mostly be inconclusive. The real answer? This question can be answered in our next segment of the Football History Rewind, so make sure you take a look back at that in part number 20. But before we go, let's talk a little bit about what happened in the 1901 season. The 1901 season finally again came to the final game in the East as it helped to shape the championship picture. Harvard and Yale met. The college football season had no clear-cut champion, with the official NCAA Division I football records listing Michigan, Yale, and Harvard as having been selected retrospectively as the national champions. The 1934 and 1935 Spalding Football Guides says that Park H. Davis once again was the lone selector of Yale to the title, but the others have found this to be an egregious error. Even the 1995 and 2009 NCAA Division I publications list Davis as selecting Yale's in 1901 champs. The belief is that after Davis died in 1934, a man named Walter Aucheson took over the position of selecting football champs of yesteryear for Spalding's guide. In 1934 and 1935's edition of the guide, Aucheson allegedly posted the retrospective postings of the selections of the top teams that Park Davis had recorded before his death. Apparently, Aucheson recorded Davis selected Yale as the 1901 champions, even though rival Harvard pounded them soundly. Another report shows that Davis selected Harvard as the champs of 1901, which makes a whole lot more sense. I think Davis's recommendations of prior years may have been erroneously recorded, as well as the records show that he selected Yale's teams that were defeated by a more definitive top team. This confirmed a Chicago Tribune article on December 31, 1901, stating that Harvard was the undisputed champions. An article written just a couple of days before the event would confirm Michigan belonged in the conversation. Anyhow, the selection committees of the Helms Athletic Association in 1941, Holgate System as late as 1926, and a National Championship Foundation in 1980 picked Michigan at 11-0 record as the top team, and a Billingsley report chose Harvard with their stellar 12-0 record. Fielding H. Yost was in just his first year at the helm of the University of Michigan program, and Yost's inaugural Wolverine 11 was the first of the coach's famed point-a-minute teams, so named for their high-scoring offense. And from 1901 to 1905, Yost's Michigan teams compiled a record of 55-1-1 and outscored their opponents by a combined score of 2,821 to just 42 by the opposition. The Wolverines gave further confirmation of being the best of the very first collegiate football bowl game. It was played following the 1901 season. Originally titled the Tournament East-West Football Game, what is now known as the Rose Bowl game was first played on January 1, 1902 in Pasadena, California. Michigan defeated a 3-1 Stanford team handily by the score of 49-0. It's too bad that Michigan was not pitted against a possibly more worthy opponent for the first granddaddy of them all. Another consideration many may have overlooked for the top spot would have been the University of California, who finished with a great 9-0-1 record in 1901. On the professional level of the game, we had a new contender at the top. As we had an earlier post of Pixie and Dispatch, we discussed how William Chase Temple took over that Duquesne Country Athletic Club. And we talk more about this in the Homestead Library Club, the champions of 1900 and 1901 in our early football program that we just had this past Monday. So make sure you take a look at that. The Homestead Stars of the early football edition. In summary, it was the Homestead Library Stars that played the Philadelphia Quakers of Blondie Wallace, and they defeated them soundly in that championship series. It was pretty much the first championship game ever at the professional level, and that's how the Homestead Stars became the great champions of professional football in 1901. You can learn more about that in our early football edition, the Homestead Stars. It was just out a couple days ago. So we're glad you joined us once again today. We hope you enjoyed the football history. Come back tomorrow for some more great football history of the day. And in a few days, we'll have another great football history rewind where we go year by year through football history covering the season of 1902. Till tomorrow, everybody, have a great Gridiron Day. That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.